minutes. Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
Yes, ma'am. Over to your right.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Audrey Marcello, representing Dollar Tree and their insurance carrier, Arch Insurance. Here on the matter of an appeal by the full commission, there's two arguments that we made on appeal: that the full commission, as it was assembled at the time of the appeal, did not have jurisdiction to render that opinion pursuant to Section 65.2200D, as well as 65.2705D. And in addition, we also appealed the opinion by the full commission that the claimant adequately marketed her residual work capacity.
At the time that your case was decided,
yes,
the three commissioners, as referenced in 65200D, were Newman, Rappaport, and Marshall, correct?
Correct.
And they meet the statutory requirements of the different backgrounds, do they not?
They do, yes, correct.
All right. So how can the full commission have been improperly constituted if the commission is composed of the three statutorily required members?
Well, on the appeal, Mr. Rappaport recused himself due to a conflict.
I understand that the panel that decided your case did not include all three commissioners, but that seems to me different than the commission being improperly constituted. Deputy Commissioner Shiblevitz did not become a commissioner. He didn't get the salary of a commissioner, the duties of a commissioner, the powers of a commissioner. He wasn't appointed by the General Assembly as required by 65-200B. He wasn't a commissioner. So the commission itself was properly constituted.
I understand that. But in the practical form in which it hears appeals and renders opinions, the commission, as it heard our appeal, did not include an employer's representative sitting at the commission.
Well, counsel, let me jump in reference to that. 75 allows for the substitute either of a deputy commissioner or a retired commission member.
Correct.
Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
Would you acknowledge that there is a difference, though, between what a deputy commissioner is versus a commission member?
There is a difference, yes.
And if you're looking at 705, how is the court to read where it indicates what the replacement is supposed to be? It indicates that the chair may appoint a deputy commissioner to participate in the review or recall one or more retired members of the commission. And when it goes on to talk about the requirements of the retired commission member, it talks about replacing the person who has to be recused. Is that fair to an accurate recitation of the statute?
Yes. Yes.
What are we to make then if it doesn't have that same requirement for the deputy commissioner?
Well, I would say that in order to read 705D as well as 65.2200D, the commission still has to follow the cadre of what 200D requires, which is to have an employer representative, a neutral, and an employee representative.
Chief, just acknowledge that a commissioner is different from a deputy commissioner, and they have different requirements. Why is it that we are to read the statutes together as you're indicating? It would seem that 705 would indicate the contrary.
Well, I think what 705 is indicating is that a deputy commissioner can be pulled up in order to hear the appeals, but I don't think that that eliminates what the commission stands for, which is to be a neutral party to hear.
If the requirements of 65-200 apply to a deputy commissioner sitting by designation under 705D, and that's your argument, right, that they have to meet those requirements, no deputy commissioner can ever meet the requirements because none of them will ever have been appointed by the General Assembly under 705B, I mean 65-200B. And so why would only the D requirements apply and not the B requirements?
I would, when I read 200D as well as 705D, I look at it in the entirety of the commission is meant to be an impartial body of an employee representative, employer's representative, and what we call a neutral representative. The way that statute reads is no more than one employee representative, no more than one employer representative, and thus a neutral party. So to me, reading it all together, the commission does have to place a deputy commissioner who is either in the background of the commissioner that they're replacing.
But unless I'm mistaken, no deputy commissioner carries within the label of employee, employer, or neutral.
No, but I would look at the background as they do when they choose a commissioner, the background
so
of
doesn't that,
that
then turn it to be subjective?
It would not be subjective if you look at the background of the deputy commissioner prior to when they were appointed as deputy commissioner, which is what they do for commissioners.
How about the service as a deputy commissioner establishing that somebody is neutral? I mean, when deputy commissioners sit on cases, they're not designated as a representative either, and they decide cases by themselves. Aren't they definitionally neutrals?
They are, but they have. We have, as attorneys trying cases before them, have the opportunity to appeal those decisions up to a neutral body of a panel of three, one of which would have an employer's representative.
To perhaps carry this too far afield, what would you say that the background of Commissioner Newman would be?
That he represented claimants as well as employers. He is designated as a neutral entity.
But if you were to look at the percentage of his background of work, what would you say that it is in terms of representing employers versus employees?
I'm not sure what that would be. What I would say is so long as he did represent, we call them claimants, not plaintiffs, but so long as he represented claimants as well as represented employers, and also I believe that Commissioner Newman also represented the Uninsured Employers Fund and self-insured employers and probably uninsured employers and probably had a long history of representing both parties, both sides.
And I guess then I think that's what I was getting around to with the point of asking that question is, doesn't it in fact make it subjective if someone doesn't carry an assigned label from the General Assembly? Because if you have a background of doing 97% employers' work and 3% claimants' work, someone could still term you as a neutral because you did work for both sides.
I would say that I would look at the deputy commissioner's position prior to the position at the commission and review what they did as a whole. So if you looked at what they did and 3% appeared to be employees and 97% was employers, and that would be an employer position.
But isn't that an arbitrary determination that the parties are going to have to make as opposed to, say, the General Assembly through a statutory scheme?
And I guess what my argument is, all I'm looking at is when I had this appeal, I did not have an employer's representative seated for the appeal.
Is it your understanding when they're sitting in their judicial capacity that they're supposed to be neutral or that they're supposed to side with one side or over the other?
Who? The deputy commissioner or
the commissioners, period.
The commissioners. I know that they are supposed to be neutral under the confines of their judicial requirement, but they are hired by the General Assembly to be an employer representative or an employee representative.
If the requirement of 65.2.200D is automatically implied into 65.2705, that you're entitled to one of each, what is the purpose of the last sentence of 705D? The retired member or members recalled shall be the member or members who occupy the seat for which such member or members are being recalled unless the parties otherwise consent. If 65.2.200D is automatically covers the situation, that sentence is not necessary, isn't it?
Well, that was amended in 2004 because prior to that it did not indicate that a retired member could be pulled. And I think that speaks to what the General Assembly intended, which was they did not want to have two employee representative commissioners.
But if your initial theory is correct, that sentence is purely surplusage, the part about drawing from the role that they had when they were on the commission, because according to you, that's already automatic, right? I mean, it doesn't. I don't need that last part of the sentence if your theory is correct.
And I'm not following your question. I'm sorry.
You're saying automatically because of the existence of 65.2.200D that every panel that hears an appeal in the commission has to be neutral, employer, claimant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why would they put the restriction on when you recall a retired member to service that he has to be for the place he's replacing if that was already the requirement anyway?
I believe that that amendment came upon because the commission pulled in a previous commissioner who was not of the seat he previously held, and that caused the amendment in 2014.
Right, because, and the General Assembly changed it because 65-200D didn't do it.
I think that the commission didn't do it. I mean, I think the message was to the commission, there needs to be three commissioners.
But they only apply that restriction, whether it's an addition, and I think given that they added it, addition is a fair characterization of it, they only apply that to a retired member or members. There is no such language in the statute regarding a deputy commissioner, is there?
No, I agree with you. There is no language there.
Well, under the very...
I would still fall on 200D, which does state that there needs to be an employer's representative there.
To break out my law school Latin, expressio unius est exclusio alterius. The listing of one thing in a statute, this restriction, applies only to the thing it's listed for and not to anything else. What do I do with that as a canon of statutory construction and find your way?
I would say that you would have to look at the statutes together, and if you read both statutes together, they both have an effect, a full force and effect, to require that the panel needs to be constituted of, with an employer's representative. And in this case, we did not have it. Moving on to the other argument, which would be that the claimant did not adequately market her residual work capacity. Just following on the this court's opinion in and the standards sent out in National Linen versus McGuinn, we contend that the claimant did not follow the framework as set out in National Linen regarding what constitutes adequate marketing.
You agree that both this court and the Supreme Court have made absolutely clear this is a purely factual question.
Yes.
Obviously, granted not the composition of the commission you wanted, the commission found as fact that the marketing was sufficient. Why is it per se legally wrong? Because they have found as fact it was, so there has to be no evidence to support that conclusion, correct?
It's simply based on looking at the law, which states that a reasonable person must, we would look at what a reasonable person would do in marketing for this period of time as a matter of what the case law requires. It is impossible that a reasonable person would continue doing what Ms. Teft did as far as marketing.
Was there any evidence about other businesses in her area hiring other than these? Was that developed?
She did not submit any testimony to that. She has the burden of proving that she is entitled to that disability.
Well, right, but if only SuperValue and Sears were hiring in the relevant geographic area and she consistently applied to them for different positions or for positions as they came open and the commission said that's reasonable, how do we say that's wrong?
It isn't reasonable. And I will say that the evidence in the record, I did ask her at the hearing, did it ever occur to you to apply to other locations other than, I can't recall whether it was Sears or SuperValue during that period of time, and she said no. And in that circumstance, it's obvious that there are other employers that she could have applied for.
But counsel, what do we do with the fact that the commission found factually that given her limitations in terms of office work, her educational limitations, her limitations working, that while it may be unwise to do what she's done, it's still reasonable? Because it seems that they've looked at other factors, so I mean, can you address it in light of all of the other factors and not just in light of the fact that she primarily applied to SuperValue and also to...
Sure.
Yeah,
I mean,
Sears.
The other factors, which include the intent of her conducting her job search, the availability of other jobs in her area, which she presented no evidence of that, and this was noted in the dissent by the full commission, it was clear in the record that she said, they told me I needed to apply for five, and when I didn't have five from Sears or SuperValue, I looked elsewhere. So her intent was simply to check the box and submit five.
But didn't she also say that she was applying for things such as loss prevention or other types of things that didn't require any lifting? I mean, she was very targeted. It wasn't just random jobs that she was applying for Super Value or for Sears, correct?
Yeah, she did apply for loss prevention and cashier and some other retail service positions. Our argument is not that the positions that she applied for were not within her restrictions. Our argument is when you're applying for 126 jobs with the same employer.
You know, I understand that, but I'm saying that collectively, if you're looking at what the commission was finding in terms of the facts, and that's one of the factors, to follow up on what Judge Russell said, how can we say that's per se wrong?
Well, I would look at what the framework as set out in National Linen, and a reason it's just not reasonable to state that a claimant who looks for work with only two employers again and again and again is reasonable and allows them to receive temporary partial disability benefits during that period of time when she hasn't really made a reasonable bona fide effort to look for work. If you have any other questions,
thank you, Ms. Marcello. And obviously, we as a panel have dominated quite a bit of your time with questions. We'll add 2 minutes on for your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gott?
If it pleases the court. Marcello. The first appeal that we've centered on is their argument that there is no jurisdiction of the commission or it was improperly constituted. One of the things in the 605 that points out is, it mentions it toward the end, is unless the other party consents. In the present matter, when we did oral argument, and as the Court of Appeals is quite aware, we don't do much oral argument at the commission level, except on a rare occasion. There was no complaint by the defendants, the carrier and the employer, to either the constitution or jurisdictional complaint or anything else of that nature.
Are you arguing that that is consent or acquiescence?
It's acquiescence only.
Well, my question on that is, did they know that Levitz had been appointed to hear it when the written... I assume this was a typical case. There was no oral argument. There was no show-up moment. That, oh, there are three of them. Oh, Shablevitz has been appointed. It was people submit their statements on review, and then you get an opinion back that tells you who sat for Rappaport, or was there notice ahead of that?
There's notice, in, at least from the implication that he sends out a thing that he's going to recuse himself, if I believe, from WebFile.
Well, right, but you don't know who they're putting in his place right then, do you?
We do not. I mean, it could, but it's always, generally it's Sablevowitz, more often than not.
It is, but they, and obviously you can't recall Roger Williams, but if the argument is, I don't know who it is until I get the opinion, I can't challenge the composition of the panel until I get the opinion.
To that extent, why I agree, it's acquiescence if there is implicit or explicit knowledge, and I believe there is, because we got a notification that there was going to be someone on there, and that gives them a duty somewhat to inquire.
But it could have been somebody with an employer's background. There are deputy commissioners with employer's backgrounds.
I agree, but you know, I'm definitely a claimant's counsel, but I also represent employers on occasion for the uninsured fund. So, that's, you know, better perceptions.
But does that consent requirement even apply? Because in 705D, that seems to only apply to me, at least by plain language, to the retired commissioner being recalled, not to the deputy commissioner.
Yes, sir. I believe it applies. It doesn't apply in this case simply because, again, when they sit, and I can't remember which one of the judges pointed it out, they sit neutrally either way. And for them to argue that the outcome would have been different or may have been different if Commissioner Rappaport had sat upon that court, and I can say from reading his opinions and being up at the commission on many, 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 many occasions with opinions, you know, they sit neutrally in my view, and to say that the outcome would have been different is really what they're arguing, that there would have been a different outcome but for. But then again, you know, looking back to whether it was jurisdiction of the commission and presently and properly constituted, you know, that's another matter, and it is upon a literal reading of the statute. There's nothing that says it is not by placing Sublevowitz in there. And to argue that he versus Newman versus Marshall, you know, probably has done a majority of claimant's work, but, you know, I've seen him on the dissent with these so-called, you know, one versus the other on issues. So to say that that is going to make the outcome different, you know, the origination of this case was a denial of everything except for a closed period of temporary total. There was then a stipulation that there was the disability arose and the continuing disability arose from the injuries resulting from the industrial accident.
But, counsel, I don't know that she's specifically arguing that it would be a different outcome. She might be intimating that, but I think the primary focus of the first assignment of error is that it's a jurisdictional one.
But there's nothing in the interpretation that says of the 705D that it's not properly constituted. And then we have to go, are we going to interview the commissioners to determine the length and extent of their history, of their work as an attorney since they, you know, rose their hand before the Supreme Court and were sworn in as an attorney? Bar number 7. I mean, that's exactly to say that we've constituted them because we don't have an employer's representative, and that is an absolute necessity for these limited cases where we have either a conflict or we have some other matter by which someone is sick or can't attend to a hearing, and any innumerable things. To have been traffic coming back and forth from, you know, Virginia Beach for Commissioner Rappaport. But to say, to quantify it, to say that one is an employer or that one is not an employer, it's a claimant's attorney by background, and that's their mindset is somehow altered, that when they sit down and they factually look at a case on marketing, whether or not there's been adequate marketing, or that the deputy commissioner's decision-making process in determining whether or not there had been adequate marketing is purely speculative at best.
Well, turning to the marketing question in this case, as I understand your argument, it's not that the commission couldn't have found that the marketing was inadequate, or whether some other commissioner would have found that the marketing was inadequate. It's that this commission, as constituted this panel, decided that it wasn't. And that's a factual question, and they're entitled to their factual conclusion. It doesn't matter that even if we had substituted in somebody else, if 98 out of 100 people would have found the marketing was insufficient, it doesn't matter because the two people that mattered found your way.
Well,
and we owe that deference.
Well, we actually go further than that. We go to the deference actually to the low man on the totem pole in the appellate scheme of things before the Industrial Commission coming up here. Is the deputy commissioner down below made a factual determination?
But neither the deputy commissioner nor we owe the deputy commissioner any deference on a question of fact such as this. They can reverse them.
They could very, very well if they believe that there was some inadequate marketing on its face, essentially.
Right. Unlike us, they don't owe that decision factual deference. We owe the commission's decision factual deference on marketing, don't we?
Well, to a great extent, yes, simply because that deputy is eyeballing that individual. They see these cases day in, day out, I don't want to say I have a premonition, but they can tell if it's really trying to adequately look for work or is it inadequate as a matter of faith because of the various factors that we all look at. You know, what one individual may do on the Eastern Shore who has a PhD in astrophysics looking for work is different than a 54, now 55-year-old lady that has a very limited vocational background and making what, in her mind, is in the commission's mind determined, is best efforts to adequately look for work within her residual capacity to work. And so even the numbers, but the factors are there. They examine the factors. The commission examined the factors and looked at the overall ones and found no fault by majority. So if we were to examine every single marketing case where one person on the Eastern Shore maybe looks at the Eastern Shore News and there's only CNA or LPN jobs over there, or you can go work at the Cherrystone Oyster Farm, but none of those fits your criteria, there's not a lot of work over there within a 50-mile radius. On the other hand, if you're in Norfolk, Virginia Beach, you have a greater opportunity given certain variables, but it's always going back to the same thing. This person, this individual, this claimant, what's their vocational background? What type of work have they held in the past? What's the nature of their restrictions? What's their educational level, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And they hear all these things, and there's an opportunity to cross-examine them in front of the deputy for those things to determine whether or not they have adequately marketed and whether or not their disability matches that and whether or not they should be awarded temporary total. Now, clearly, she didn't market up to a certain point, and the commission, deputy commissioner, found that there was no marketing up till the point of the award being entered. And obviously, I'm not going to appeal that, although we all know the statutes and the act do not mention the word marketing anywhere in it. It's a self-brought forth idea that somebody who wants benefits has to show that they're entitled to benefits and that have, just like the Employment Commission, you know, looked for work to make them eligible because there's no other way that they could avoid having the economic loss. But the jurisdiction, I think, you know, to measure the rap reports or anybody else's who wasn't on there, or, you know, is Newman A or B, you know, as to their background as an employer versus claimants counsel, is not what that statute contemplated. And the having the ability that if someone is not available, cannot be seated or can't be utilized for whatever reason, they can't be there that day, that the work would go on with the commission and not be pushing these back and essentially administratively piling these things up. They move on in their work. On the second one, the only remaining one, the deputy commissioner found that the marketing was adequate. She testified to various factors involving her vocational background and her efforts. She's not being assisted by vocational counselors in endeavoring to find her work or assisting in finding her work. If they had complained when she's going out on a job, the employer and the carrier have the absolute right to assign vocational placement if they want to reduce their exposure or reduce their payments by assisting in finding work for those that they perceive are inadequate in their marketing efforts. They did no such thing. And for those reasons, I've requested the commissioner's, original commissioner's opinion be upheld. If I have no further question.
Thank you, Mr. Scott.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, please. Thank you. Ms. Marcello.
Very briefly, Your Honors, with respect to Mr. Guybe's comments regarding acquiescence of the panel, just to refresh his recollection on what occurred, we did have oral argument before that panel. We were not given any notice prior to the oral argument that our Deputy Commissioner Shklubovitz would be the commissioner in the place of Mr. Rappaport. In fact, in the opinion issued by the full commission, which is on appeal right now, that was where it was indicated why Mr. Rappaport did not hear that appeal from the deputy commissioner level. So we did file a motion for reconsideration after receiving the opinion, but it was not acquiescence because at the time in which the appeal was heard, we did not know until the judges walked in who was going to be seated there. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And consistent with the tradition of the court, we will come down.